Thank you.
And again, we're happy to share, especially the ones that probably folks couldn't hear through the mics. But yeah, we can jump in.
Yes. Anything Thank you, everybody, for participating. I appreciate it.
All right, so you all are probably familiar more with our prevention education programming. We're very fortunate to have the support from the board for many years for that programming, but are really excited to have the opportunity to come out and talk more about our trauma-based therapy services. This is the first year that the Champaign County Mental Health Board is funding a significant portion of our therapy services, and that has been primarily in response to the fact that statewide there was a decrease of $9.5 million in federal VOCA funds for sexual violence services. And I always say this, I feel so fortunate that when something like this happens, that we're located in this community. I'm very constantly in contact with directors of other centers who laid off staff, who are no longer providing services in certain areas. There are whole hospitals in Chicago that no longer have medical advocates because of this reduction. So I feel very fortunate that we were able to be in a community that saw the value of our work, and we're really excited to get to talk to you all more about our therapy services. Next slide, please.
Excuse me. And so I'll go ahead and talk to you all about our counseling team. So currently, there are four of us on staff, and we are all registered as the trauma therapist there at the facility. We just recently had a staff member who stepped down from their position, and so we are looking to fill that position. So total, we are staffed with five therapists. And I just recently switched from being a trauma therapist there, which I'm still going to do that, but I'm going to switch and take the community outreach position. So I'll be a little bit more involved in the community, be out and about to promote our services, run groups, and facilitate workshops as well for the community, which I'm super excited about because it's something I've done previously, and so now I kind of get to step back into that role, which is super, super duper exciting. All of our clinicians have master's level experience. Most of us in the office have an LSW or more as far as credentials when it comes to being certified. Next slide, please. Yes. And then this is just a little bit more of a breakdown to let you all know specifically the two positions that you've been funding. You've been funding Athena. She is a MSW and LSW employee with us. She's been working in the mental health field for over 10 years. She is licensed and credentialed as an LSW. I believe she's in the pursuit for clinical hours as well, and so am I. You know, it's a long, drawn-out process if you are doing that. Lots of money, lots of supervision. And then I am Kayla. Just recently joined the team in September. I love what I do, and I am Triple P certified, and I'm also in the process of completing a program intervention. It's called CPP, which is Child Parent Psychotherapy. So that process is about 18 months long worth, and once I'm finished, I will be on a national database and register to provide that intervention. That intervention is for folks birth to 4 years old to utilize for intervention, and so I'm working on getting that completed. Super excited about it. It's going to be another good resource and intervention that we can use to help children and families who need additional support. Next slide, please. Thank you. So all of our services at RACES, they are free and confidential. Anybody who has experienced some type of sexual violence, domestic violence, can request service. If you are a survivor, you can request support, and if you are a supporter, you can also request support. So a supporter can take the form of a parent, a friend, a significant other, a partner, siblings, I'm trying to think, aunts, uncles, you name it. Anybody can be a supporter to a survivor. So as long as that is connected back to a sexual assault or domestic violence incident, we can provide a service to those folks.
We'll just clarify, domestic violence does have to be related to sexual violence. Otherwise, we do refer over to Courage Connection. We also do help people who've experienced stalking, and we're seeing a large increase in the requests for services for folks who have experienced stalking as well. I think another thing that I would just stress in terms of some of what Kayla has shared, we are very intentional about having master's level clinicians. There's lots of great folks who are doing great work who might not have those particular credentials. but with working with a population that has experienced often complex trauma related to sexual violence, we want to make sure that people have the expertise to provide the same level of care as if someone was going to a clinician in private practice with a trauma focus. Our services are free. They should still be the highest possible quality available to people. We also have an additional benefit in that when we say that we're confidential, we have absolute privilege. So most mental health privilege is a qualified privilege, right? So if someone is a therapist at another agency or in private practice, if there's a court case and a judge, if they get a subpoena, the judge says, I'm going to review those records, the judge has every right to do that. If we get subpoenaed, we can say, no, you cannot have them. Our privilege is absolute, so unless there is a waiver on file, we can quash any subpoena that comes in, and that is something that is specifically included in state law and is very important for a lot of our clients who might be concerned about other people knowing that they've experienced sexual violence or stalking.
Okay. Yes, ma'am. Thank you. Next slide, please. About our intern.
Oops.
Alrighty. So next up, we will talk to you all about our service area, who we serve. So we serve any individual who has experienced sexual violence or trauma over the age of 3. We serve the following counties, so Champaign, Ford, Douglas, and Piatt. At some point, it would be nice for us to take on some more counties, but baby steps first, serve the folks that we have, and then move forward from there. And then we offer different types of counseling or therapy service. So we can do individual groups, family, and like I said, we do also run like different types of support groups. So that would be like our group counseling. And we will definitely talk to you all a little bit about what those look like as well. Next slide, please. Anything you want to add for those?
No, I think on the next one.
Okay. Alrighty, and so next we have the different type of clinical interventions that each of our therapists use. So this is a brief list of all of the interventions that we've either been introduced to, we've used, either some that we are learning a little bit more about or developing our skills for. And so we use all of those to interact with our clients, but not limited to just those. So for example, I just recently got registered to do the EMDR training, which I'm super excited about. I believe, and Jaya, correct me if I'm wrong, we are probably one of the only agencies here in this area that offers EMDR for free. Any other location that you go to for services or therapy and you want to participate in that particular type of intervention, you do have to pay for it. But because our services are free and confidential and we are a nonprofit that is free for folks, they have the option to request a service if they want it. We don't force it upon anybody if they want that, but we offer it as an option if it's something that they like to try. Research has shown that it is very helpful for folks who have experienced severe trauma.
So just a little bit more in terms of our numbers for treatment clients. We currently have 93 in Champaign County. We also have quite a few that we plan to serve through this grant related to our medical and legal advocacy services. It's been interesting to see that medical advocacy requests have not been quite as high this fiscal year as last fiscal year. I think some of that is a residual effect of the pandemic, where we saw an incredible increase in sexual assault cases coming into the emergency department. But we have already provided services to 78 individuals in the emergency department. Our criminal request for support during criminal cases has increased this fiscal year. So we have about 7 different cases for criminal cases, 22 civil, and then we have an additional 24 individuals who've requested more general support services who might be receiving other services as well. The need for case management and access to other services has really increased in the clients that we're serving, especially since some of the COVID-specific programs have started to end. We're really seeing people struggle with things like food, rent. How are they going to get places? So we're doing our best to meet those needs or connect folks with other services as best we can. We don't differentiate in our database between when we're just providing information and when it's a direct referral, but we have provided either information or referral over 1,000 times this fiscal year already. So I think other than that, just highlighting, we also said we were going to be doing community events, which we've been very active in. Our staff overall has participated in 16 different community events. this fiscal year so far. We're very excited to be providing crisis intervention services to the performances of Usual Girls at the Station Theater. We will have folks on site for every single one of those performances because they are talking about sexual violence, and we'll be doing a talk back with their during their last performance as well to make sure that we're engaging in that conversation with the community. So having this larger team is really important for us to be able to engage with the community in a variety of ways in addition to the direct therapy services that we're providing. And I think we can move on to our next slide.
Excuse me. So next up, we'll talk about you all with our wait list. Unfortunately, since we are an organization that does provide free services, we have experienced an influx of folks wanting to come in for services. And because of that, it does kind of limit the amount of people that we can serve right at that particular time. And since our services are free, we don't close out people right away unless that's something that they're requesting. So anybody can have that counseling or support as long as they like to. So if they want it to be short term, just for a couple of weeks, couple months, they can have that option. And then there are some clients who have been coming back and forth to RACES for years and they haven't ended their services yet. So the way it works, you get on the wait list for therapy. We would do an intake, so some people call the hotline to get put on the wait list. Some folks can call the office directly to request information and referrals. We try to get back to people within 72 hours to complete a screening questionnaire. The screening questionnaire is a detailed list of questions that determines best fit for services, who would be a best match for them therapeutic-wise. And also, there's a portion that kind of asks folks, what's your availability like? What's the best time of day to give you a call? Is it safe or okay for us to leave you a voicemail or to even leave you messages? Because some people do not feel confident or safe enough to leave voicemails, especially if they are currently running from a situation or fleeing. They don't want people to know that they are trying to access services or support. And we try to be very mindful and respectful of that to keep people's confidentiality at bay. And then we would do the same thing as well for groups, complete an intake session, same thing. We also have a wait list for groups as well. And like I said, we'll talk a little bit more about groups and the way that they work. They work a little bit different. And so like I said, we do have a wait list, so sometimes it does get kind of backed up. And so what we do, we go through bi-monthly, go back through the wait list and call folks that we haven't been able to get in contact with who've requested service. And most of the time, folks, when we call back, they either will decline services because they've found somewhere else in the meantime, they've moved out of state, or that situation has either been resolved. Some people have changed phone numbers or relocated because of the situation, and we're unfortunately no longer to get a hold of them. But we do keep everything still written down and documented just in case we need to go back to it or if it ever gets pulled or audited or what have you.
And it might sound like, I know anytime someone's talking about a waiting list, it's unfortunate, right? When I came back to RACES as the executive director about 2.5 years ago, we only had 2 therapists on staff. It had previously been 4, but during the pandemic, there was that decrease. We're at 5 now, and we still have a waiting list. We'd love to continue to grow. The need is there. But like Kayla said, we also don't just kick people out. There are a lot of centers that do provide free services, that they cap the number of sessions, and I understand they want to reach a wider range of people. But the way we understand trauma and being survivor-centered is that they lead, we follow. It's important for us that people are able to decide when they're ready to disengage from services and make sure that they've actually received the support that they need or want in that moment. So that is important for us. But we also recognize, right, that we do see that attrition where people are dropping off while they're on the waiting list. And so that's where our therapy team developed that process of doing the initial screening and then checking in, right? Is there a referral that we can provide for people? Would it be helpful to have a crisis intervention in-person meeting to kind of support them until we're able to get them in with a therapist on a regular basis? Because that period of, if someone gets to the point where they're ready to reach out for support, we want to be able to provide it as quickly as possible. But unfortunately, sometimes we are still looking at months out because we do have that need that exceeds our ability to meet it even with 5 full-time therapists.
Next slide, please. Alrighty. Hotline. So here at Races, we offer a free 24-hour confidential hotline that folks can use to request medical advocacy that is after hours. So if it's a Monday, Wednesday, or Friday past 5 p.m., they can call that number and get any type of support that we can offer. And then Tuesday, Thursdays, 8, if it's after 7 p.m., they can call that number as well. It's crisis intervention. It is available, like I said, 24/7. It is ran by Races staff and volunteers. We get who knows how many number of calls we get a day. It depends. Sometimes most of the questions are general information questions that we do get on the hotline, and then we have some instances where those calls are immediate crisis. They say, "Hi, something just happened. I think that I was assaulted. I'd like to go to the hospital, or I'm not even sure what to do. Can you help me?" And so that's what that hotline is utilized for. It's for immediate crisis intervention, but sometimes it's not just for that, but that's what the main goal and purpose of it is.
And we have provided crisis intervention services to 138 individuals this fiscal year so far, and most of that would be through the hotline. All right, one more, I think, chunk in terms of our work on group services.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, so groups. We offer group services and support. So we currently have an adult support group that meets weekly on Thursdays from 5:30 to 7. The group is open to 10 members, and they kind of fluctuate. Things happen in folks' lives. So sometimes attendance is good. Sometimes it's not the best. It just kind of depends. Like I said, when you do trauma work, something happens, things hit the fan, and then people need a break or time out from services or therapy, because it does start to become overwhelming once you open up some of these deep wounds and these deep traumas. And once you have that on top of your everyday life and something happens, it kind of throws everything off kilter. But the support group is open to any adult survivors and supporters over 18. This one is just for survivors. Mm-hmm. Yeah, this one's just our survivor support group. We are actually in the works on making some other groups that are for supporters as well. And so these groups, people can seek validation, support from other survivors as well as get guidance and be in an environment that feels welcoming, comfortable, and safe, and know where they'll be heard and understood, and other people will be able to understand their experiences, and so they don't feel alone. And we are always looking to grow the list for group members, because group services, they've shown that research is really good, especially when it comes to trauma. It helps to know that there's a community of folks out there who've experienced the same things as you, and you don't have to sit alone with any of these experiences. The groups that we're currently going to be in the works, it's not on there just yet, but we are going to start a group. It's called Raising Sexually Healthy Children. It's going to be for adult survivors, for parents who are survivors of childhood abuse, kind of helping them to talk to their children about what it means to raise healthy sexual children, kind of the things to look for, prevention and education, and if they have questions or anything like that that they want to ask or need support with, that's what that'll be utilized for. And then also I'm working on, within the next few months, I'll give myself some baby steps, a teen support group for youth who have experienced sexual abuse and trauma. It's important to reach the youth in this community. They are really, really struggling, and we want them to be able to have a safe and comfortable outlet to talk about some of these issues, because we know that you can't always do it at school. And I believe that's all that I have.
Yeah, there's the questions.
And if you guys have any questions, I'm all ears, because after this, I'm going to serve our youth, 3rd through 5th grade girls at Urbana Park District for some basketball this evening.
I was wondering, talking about like groups and stuff, how much work you guys do like with the UP Center? Because I know that's a area that there's a lot of assault in.
Absolutely. So we work very closely with Uniting Pride, and actually had plans to do a group specifically for LGBTQ+ youth. We just didn't have a large enough group of youth to start that program. It is something we still would like to do, but It is a matter of making sure that there's a good number of young folks who want that particular service. That's something that we talked about doing at their office. That is something, you know, Kayla was mentioning switching into the outreach role, that we really do try to meet folks where they already feel comfortable as often as we can. So while our office, we work to make it as inviting an environment as possible, it's not unusual for us to be meeting with folks at school, at other service providers' offices. We're always looking for opportunities to partner with folks to reduce those barriers. And absolutely, you know, Uniting Pride is a big one of those. It just, I think it's really difficult to open that door for a lot of youth, especially if they're just trying to feel safe. And right now, with everything that's happening in the world, diving into trauma in terms of just, you know, on top of just trying to live, right, can be a lot.
And again, you've got two things there that you're challenged with in the society. I mean, and again, I'm thankful Champaign-Urbana, this area is pretty accepting, but those are two big things, yeah, that are, you know. Yeah, so well, I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the LGBTQ plus population experiences disproportionately high rates of sexual violence, so we do everything that we can to make sure that folks know that we're a safe and, you know, accessible resource for folks.
I just want to say that was a very thorough presentation, because the questions that came up got answered before. Do you service any men?
Yes, we do.
Okay.
We serve folks of all genders. A lot of folks who reach out to us, I do identify as women. I think that there are a lot of folks who are male survivors who, there are additional barriers, right? Just,
yeah,
being able to reach out for support can be hard. And so, again, thinking about what can we be doing, and that's, again, where our prevention program, these two things have to go hand in hand, right? Creating that exposure, making sure that people understand that we are a resource for everybody, really starts with that prevention focus, but then also, you know, we're out wherever we can be in the community, making sure that folks know that. And I really appreciate you asking that question, because I think historically people think about this as, you know, the women's movement, and so many places have that kind of language behind it, but absolutely making sure that we're, that people know that we're a resource for folks of all genders is important to us.
Perfect, perfect. Thank you.
Yeah, as Kayla was saying, anyone can be assaulted, anyone can experience sexual violence or stalking, just like anyone can commit acts of sexual violence or stalking.
You serve a 4-county area. Mm-hmm. Do you have offices or places in those, or
we
do people come here?
Yeah, so we're located here in Urbana, and we do have a contractual therapist who has an office in Rantoul. So again, we do try to keep barriers limited as much as we can. We are a small but mighty team. So like we do travel. Kayla's been traveling to some of our other service. Other parts of our service area quite a bit recently, actually. We did actually try to have another contractual therapist in another one of our counties, but what we heard from clients was that it felt like it was too identifiable, right? Because if it's a smaller community, you park outside of a therapist's office, that then it became too obvious. Mm. So some of what we do to try to reduce those barriers, aside from providing transportation assistance, is offering phone and virtual services as well. So if people can't get to us, again, we do our best to reach them in whatever way we can. Yeah.
I guess that leads to a question that I was wondering about. I have a few. What have you noticed in terms of as the pandemic has changed over time? I know for a long time, many therapists were doing mostly virtual services. Have you noticed any trends back to more,
yes,
in-person, or is virtual still remaining very popular?
I would say that Kayla's saying it's a combo, but a lot of clients do prefer that in person. And that was part of it during the pandemic, we didn't have any group services. We hadn't for a while, but that was part of the impetus for creating the outreach and group services position, because we were hearing from people that they really needed that community. They needed to be able to connect with other folks. And that has been the case for individual services too, that we keep those options for virtual and phone, and that's totally up to the individual, right? Whichever format works best for them. But we have a lot of clients who, being in person, being able to interact with their therapist, you know, face to face, is really important for them. So it's a mix.
This is kind of on a little bit of a different vein, but I know that doing this work can be very, very challenging, as somebody who's worked in,
yeah,
a lot in collaboration with,
yeah,
racists for most of my career. I was wondering, I'm so glad to see that the therapist team has grown so much over the years. How do you all, balance, taking care of our community and taking care of yourselves and like balancing kind of caseloads and things like that?
Yeah, absolutely. I really appreciate that question. I can certainly say for myself as an executive director that that's essential, right? While we're here to serve our community, we can't do that if we're not taking care of the folks who are providing that service. So we do cap caseloads, which, you know, when you've got a waiting list, it's hard to do. But again, if we're burning folks out, and, you know, Kayla mentioned that we had, you know, a therapist leave recently. They went into private practice. We had one other therapist who's left during this fiscal year because they moved out of the country. What we're hearing when people leave is that they're not leaving because they're dissatisfied with our office, but because they're moving on for other opportunities. My goal, and certainly Kayla can say how effective this is to make sure that we are being really in tune to how are folks doing, whether that's related to the clients that they're serving, whether that's related to events happening in the world or in our community, because those things impact our clients and our staff as well. But really being intentional about making time for folks to engage in healthy practices, not just self-care, but also what is the agency's responsibility for caring for folks, whether that's continuing education, whether that's providing adequate time away when folks need it, and absolutely making sure that we're not asking people to take on too many clients, even though it's really hard to say, I'm sorry, you have to wait. I'd rather ask people to wait a couple months than to wait a couple years because we can't find the right person. I don't know if you'd add anything.
Yeah, I think you did a good job at explaining that. I would say what I've noticed about working here at RACE is they do make sure that they put make sure that the employees have what they need in order to succeed. So for the counseling team, we utilize biweekly supervision, individual and group, so we get supervision with an outside contractor, and then we also have supervision with our direct supervisor who has their LCSW. So I have weekly supervision with them, and then I meet with another individual every 2 weeks to get supervision as well. I utilize my own therapy as well to help cope and balance and regulate with taking on this role. And we also use each other. The work environment here at RACE is very good. Everybody has each other's backs as far as checking in to make sure that folks have what they need mentally. And we just try to do a good job at communicating with each other is the best way that I would say that we do. It's trying to keep a good work-life balance. It does get challenging at times. The past few weeks have been a little hectic, but I think the best thing that we do, we're a team. We don't let anybody suffer alone.
I do have one last question, kind of, and this I think reflects back on the last presentation as well, looking at how the funding has changed over time. I still remember when RACES was down to only you working there, Jaya, back in, 2016, I think. I just saw a few days ago that there's potentially going to be more cuts to VOCA coming, and I wondered if you could speak to that and what the landscape is for funding at the federal and state level, because once again, I'm concerned about these higher levels of funding advocating their responsibility to take care of the communities.
What is in the proposed federal budget would be a significant decrease across the country. Again, in terms of VOCA, there are a lot of organizations that are working to try to address that fact. So we'll see what happens with that. There are also conversations. There was some funding that became available to sexual violence services during the pandemic. There's some significant efforts to try to make that long term, which would certainly make a difference as well. We're also seeing our coalition, the Illinois Coalition Against Sexual Assault, actively lobby the state to increase funding. So sexual violence services, we do not lobby. We're nonprofit without any registered lobbyists. We let our coalition handle that. But general revenue funding from the state has remained flat for about two decades in Illinois. So currently statewide, it's a $7 million allocation. ICASA, our coalition, is asking to increase that to 20. Just for reference, domestic violence services recently increased to $50 million. So It's, you know, still not on par, but it would make a significant difference. So there are definitely efforts. There will actually be a rally in March that I'm happy to share more information as I have it at the state capitol to encourage our state to adequately invest in survivor services. But it's a constant question of, you know, what is going to be the impact of the federal legislation. That's something that, of course, makes a huge difference to me. And like I said, I feel very fortunate that we're in this community. But I also don't want to keep having to come back to our local funders because of what's happening at the state or federal level. So we are continuing to push. We're continuing. Also, I always am keeping my eye out for what else is out there, right? How do we make sure that we're not putting all of our eggs in one basket, because unfortunately this is the nature of nonprofit work. As the previous presenter shared, is there's always that question of what might happen, and the last thing I want to do is to reduce services or let any one of my amazing team members go.
Thank you for sharing that. I'm glad to see that there's efforts, both looking at the federal potential cuts to try to address that and also the state level to get, I mean, hearing that the funding's been flat for two decades is just appalling.
Slightly increased, just almost flat. Slightly increased. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for sharing that. Does anybody else have any comments or questions?
I have a question if the online folks don't. My question is, you caught my attention, Caleb, when you mentioned the teen support group. Mm-hmm. I know you all are in the infancy stages of developing the group. Any ideas what the capacity number is for that group? And then the other question is, are you looking at virtual or in person? Because I think in person, as we know, is more dynamic. Mm-hmm. So those are my two questions.
Yes. So I'll answer the second one first, because you said it first, or that's what my brain's registering. Yeah. I would definitely do in-person services, especially when it comes to the teens. They love their screens. This is going to be an environment where there's no screen. We want the face-to-face interaction, the people skills, the social-emotional learning. Not saying that having a screen is not beneficial, but in order to engage in this work, I feel that the screen would be a little distracting for them. So we would try to implement the, oh, please put your phone away policy. I'm not going to take anybody's stuff when they walk through the door, because that's triggering for folks to take their belongings. So I wouldn't do that. But just telling folks to be mindful. This is a space where we want you to be fully present and engaged. So try to remain off your electronics, which can be difficult for teens, but that would be the goal. It would be in person. I've been trying to figure out what I would keep the cap at, especially when you're talking about a room full of teenagers. I don't need 20, 25 teenagers off the charts in one room. I think maybe about 15 to start, to see if we get a little bit of a flow. And I know that we are flexible. We can either keep more members, take some away, but we can kind of leave the flow open. I wouldn't facilitate the group by myself. I would have another therapist in the office also help co-facilitate, who is funded to work with Urbana Youth. So we will be working together to facilitate that.
Thank you. You answered my last question. Thanks.
You are welcome.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your presentation. It was great to hear from you all.
Thank you. Thank you so much for your time.
And I will turn it back over to Leon to introduce our last presenter.
No, that's okay. All right. I'll see you in the morning.
Peter, good friends. So tell Chris that hi.
Hello.
I saw him. I sent her a message.
You did? Are the cards somewhere? If I can collect those back so we can reuse them.
I'd love to keep my card, but you can have it back. There you go. Thank you.
That's a great.
All right, Jay. All right.
I guess it affirmed the entire community that could be held in.
Do you all want a third chair?
It's a, if David would like to. Why not? The more the merrier.
Yeah. If you don't mind being on this side. Is that okay?
You don't want to be up here? It's your choice. Glad that you're here.
Okay, so we have our last and but very important group, Immigrant Services of CU, and the presenter is Miss Maria Jimenez, and she is a case manager. Along with her, we have the board president for Immigrant Services, Mr. David Dorman. And then we have the new executive director, Mr. Trey Irving Thomas, who is also present. And so Maria will provide an update on the immigrant mental health program. Maria, take it away.
Thank you so much, Leon. I don't think I've ever spoken into a microphone before, so this is exciting. So I'll just wait for the slide to come up. Yeah. Present. That's okay. It should do. I can see. That's all right.
All right.
Well, I want to start off by saying thank you for having us today. Immigrants in our community are absolutely facing a mental health crisis, and the work that we're able to do in collaboration with you guys is absolutely paramount to trying to tackle that. So yeah, excited to be here. You can go ahead for the next slide. That's okay. It's okay. So we wanted to start off by giving you guys an idea of our vision and our mission. You might have to move the people there just so, yeah, it's okay. That's okay. It's okay. So our vision is a future where every immigrant, refugee, and asylum seeker finds a welcoming and supportive community that empowers them to thrive. We envision a society where these individuals not only overcome challenges but also embrace opportunities. To me, that word thrive is incredibly important because we're dealing with a population that is stuck in survival for many reasons, for lack of resources, because their lives are being uprooted from the only home they've ever known, and they're coming here to try to live a better life. And so we don't just want to give them the resources to be able to make it on a day-to-day basis in terms of survival. We really want to continue to establish a relationship that highlights their skills and their talents and the things that they would like to bring to the community, and help them learn how to integrate those things, as hard as it may be. And our mission is centered around aiding new immigrants, refugees, and asylum seekers in their journey to integrate into our community. We are dedicated to helping these individuals make a transition from dependency to achieving complete self-sufficiency, enabling them to become valuable contributors to our community. So I already touched a little bit on that, but I definitely want to highlight the self-sufficiency component, because when you're working with a population that faces lack of language access, meaning they can't just walk into any place and be like, yeah, can I have this service, or I need this, or can you help me with this? Language access is a huge barrier to being able to navigate your community. So as service providers, we're very susceptible to going into these spaces with them and doing things for them, right? Oh, I'm going to fill out this form for you because it's easier if I do it than if I translate every single line on this 3-page form, right? So as much as it would make it easier for us to just go into these spaces and do, we really want to promote autonomy. There's nothing probably more disempowering than coming into a country. I'm an immigrant myself, so I can speak to that. And not knowing how to navigate anything, not knowing traffic laws, not knowing that, oh, when the weather's bad, things close, you know, not knowing how to navigate all of these things that we all take for granted. So we don't want to create a codependent relationship in which these immigrants and their clients are not able to navigate anything without our help. We really, really want to, like I said, promote that autonomy and help them be able to navigate things on their own, which means taking the time to slow down and teach things for the very first time. Next slide. So I'll go over our programs and our services. So as a case manager, our approach is incredibly holistic. It supports our clients in various aspects, conducting depression screenings, connecting clients with mental health services, legal aid, addressing concerns like food insecurity, medical care, housing, employment, education. One thing about this population is that the need is great, and the needs are also intersectional. So it means housing is an issue. There's, you know, a medical crisis as well. They're not able to access health care the way that other populations are. So whatever it is that they might need, I think a lot of it comes down to advocacy and just being there to help them navigate, being a person that they can have alongside them to support them as they learn how to navigate everything. Transportation, this is a pretty critical one. One thing that I'll say is that three of our most important programs are not funded. So they're through unrestricted funds, which is incredibly difficult, because it means we're often in the position where we have to choose how and when to help. So with transportation, we have individuals seeking asylum who have maybe been in the country and in Champaign for only 2 or 3 days before they come and find us, right? So they're coming to us with absolutely nothing and just documents that say, hey, you have to go to immigration court on this date. And if they don't, they face deportation, right? Even if they do qualify for asylum. So being able to coordinate to get transportation for them to go to those court dates, maybe some of them came in through the border in New York, but they're here in Champaign and their appointment is going to be in New York. Okay, well, our staff knows how to change the address so that their appointment is going to be in Chicago, right? So it's about making that more accessible and helping them even know this is what's going to happen. You know, we often buy bus passes, bus tokens to Chicago, train passes. If we can't find a volunteer, we have a volunteer approach with that where we like to have someone that's able to actually drive them and help them navigate. But whatever it is, you know, our approach is to try to make sure they get to where they need to go because those appointments are critical. Warehouse, this program extends a helping hand to new immigrants by providing gently used furniture and household items. This initiative operates through our volunteer-run warehouse, fueled by donations from our community members. So one thing you learn about us is we love volunteers and we try to incorporate them as much as possible. This program is also critical in the sense that you have individuals that maybe have a place to stay, and maybe it doesn't even have a fridge, doesn't have a lamp, doesn't have overhead lighting. Maybe they don't even have pots and pans. They don't have a bowl to eat off of, whatever it might be. So being able to sit with them and rely on our warehouse to be like, okay, this is what we can provide so they have some items to put into their new home. A lot of immigrants are living with up to like 6, 7, 8 other people that are not even their family sometimes. So this is, yeah, like I said, incredibly important. Emergency food assistance, again, is another program that we have that's not funded, but the program provides emergency food assistance to new arrivals or immigrants who are facing an emergency need for food. This one's kind of hard just in the sense that it's really difficult to define what is or isn't an emergency food need, because if they're coming to you, it likely is already at the point where it's an emergency. We try to prioritize families with kids, of course, and there's different barriers that we face there. Bus passes, this is one of my favorite ones. In collaboration with the Community Foundation of Illinois, bus passes are paid for in full for immigrants as to provide them with an accessible means of transportation. So being able to navigate your community is being able to get around and go to where you need to go. Maybe you learn how to go somewhere on your own, but can you get there? So this is, again, incredibly important. And having that collaboration with Community Foundation of Illinois makes it much more accessible. We can get approval for a bus pass in like 1 or 2 days. And then as much as we can, sometimes we find ourselves in situations where we're helping clients learn how to use the bus system because language access comes into that as well. So we're really just here to try to help in whatever way that it is that we can. Next slide, please. So I'll focus a little bit more on that mental health program. So the Immigrant Mental Health Program has been successful in consistent referrals and scheduling of mental health therapy sessions, to the addition of myself, the Spanish bilingual case manager, who serves the dual role of mental health coordinator. We have incorporated mental health services into our case management, so they're incredibly interdependent. For the past fiscal year, ISU has been covering the cost of mental health services provided by our partnership with Community Health Partnership of Illinois. CHP takes on a holistic approach to client care and provides health and wellness checkups for each client to determine physical health as well. The CHP team we collaborate with for this project consists of two psychiatrists and two counselors who are English, Spanish, bilingual, and provide teletherapy to our Spanish-speaking clients from CHP's office. A thing to note there that I think I'll actually give an example of like a client situation. So if we had a client that was undergoing DV and was referred to us for mental health services, and prior to being able to ease into the idea of sharing this very, you know, horrendous trauma with a mental health practitioner, her major concern was first her own health, right? Had she been exposed to an STD, all of these things. So we really enjoy being able to collaborate with them in the sense that holistically our clients are going there and getting a health checkup, and then they're beginning their mental health sessions. And of course, not all of them want to have that health checkup, but it's just not something that's very accessible anywhere else to them, particularly not for free. So we're very proud to be able to offer that. I think one thing that you'll notice that I'll touch on again later is that this is just English and Spanish. As you likely know, you know, immigrants don't just speak Spanish. So that's definitely a goal for us in the future, is to continue to expand these services so that we can serve every community that is an immigrant, which means a lot of other languages. Next slide. Service plan. So once a client has been referred to CHP to receive services, a service plan is created. With training from the ISCU board member who has her LCSW, our case manager conducts the PHQ-9, which is a 9-question diagnostic tool utilized to assess the presence and severity of depression. As the client completes their first 6 sessions, we remain accessible to each client, meeting their needs outside of mental health, using the organization's resources and services. After 6 sessions, we perform the post-screening assessment utilizing the same screening tool to discuss progress. So obviously this has very logistical benefits, but I will actually say, being the one that conducts the screenings, there's a very powerful moment that happens when you're going through a PHQ-9 with someone and they start to realize that maybe they didn't think they had depression, but now they're like, wait, I haven't been sleeping well. My appetite has gone down or gone up, or, you know, all of these like somatic symptoms that are part of mental health that maybe we don't necessarily correlate unless we've had the education to, with it being like depression or anxiety or whatever it is. So there's like kind of like an aha moment that happens in that session where somebody starts to have that mind and body connection that I think is crucial anytime we're talking about mental health. And continuing to provide the case management and continuing to provide resources and staying available. So not just making the referral and being like, okay, it's in CHP's hands now, but staying there, because sometimes maybe they want to debrief with you. Maybe they want to tell you how it's going. Maybe, you know, they're sure their mental health needs are being met, but they can't quite relax into it because they're still facing all of these other things that other resources are needed to meet. So thank you. Yeah. Next slide. And then these are the mid-year numbers. So non-treatment plan contacts, 263, service contacts, 65, referrals, 61, and community service events, 4. Next slide. And then program highlights. I chose a success story for this one. It's very near and dear to my heart, but a young mother and her 3 children immigrated to the United States from Honduras after her husband was assassinated. The mother describes her arrival into our offices as miraculous, as her family and her almost died several times while fleeing violence, sickness obtained from homeless shelters, and the delivery of her baby in transit. She originally came into my office seeking assistance with food for her and her children. Upon taking the time to hear her story, she shared how traumatized she felt that her 12-year-old daughter had become. She described that her daughter was unable to sleep at night, unable to be in the dark, and having anxiety nonstop throughout the day. I shared with her the mental health services we could offer, and she was elated to hear that she and her daughter could speak to someone in Spanish. She then felt safe enough to express that she also felt she herself would benefit from therapy. Thanks to her partnership with CHP, she was able to have her health assessed, which she was concerned with after all the illness they contracted during their travels, and they both have been assisting therapy ever since. I think I'll touch on this as the slides go on, but one very powerful thing about this position and about working with this population is that sometimes you're the very first person that this individual has ever had a trauma-related conversation with. You're the first person they've ever disclosed, yeah, sometimes I do wonder if my mental health isn't okay. And just holding space for that and not, you know, going through an intake and being like, what's your information? But just having it, tell me about your immigrant story. Tell me about how you immigrated. Tell me about why you chose to come here. The trauma starts to unravel. And when you're able to hold space for that and just say, hey, we have a resource that I think maybe could be right for you, but not saying this is what you need, is very, very powerful. Next slide, please. Challenges. One of many, but due to social stigmas within the immigrant community and a lack of awareness around mental health, at times it can be challenging to reach individuals out in the community. Typically, it can take long sit-down sessions with the case manager to ease the client into accepting mental health services as a tool and resource that could work for them. For this reason, the marketing of our mental health program is not usually as successful out in the community as opposed to the case management approach, which takes time. Being from this community myself, I can speak to the fact that the amount of stigma around mental health is, a huge barrier, hard to overcome. I mean, these are communities in which you weren't allowed to say that you were depressed, despite the fact that you likely have CPTSD, if not PTSD. You're not able to talk about that. Being the first person often that's ever introducing to them how, hey, therapy is not just for people who are crazy, because that is the stigma that people come with, and being able to just kind of, you know, bounce off how talking to someone else about it can help them begin to process it in a new way is incredibly important. So it's not always just like, you have a client come in and you're like, hey, by the way, we have a mental health program. And they're like, oh, yeah, awesome, cool, sign me up. It takes time to establish that relationship, to establish that safety, and for them to see, oh, wow, I'm really benefiting from talking to you. I wonder if I would benefit from talking to someone who is actually trained to do it. And then, like I mentioned before, just the challenge of it's not just about having language access that's in Spanish. It's about every other language that we're seeing, including indigenous tongues. So there's always efforts to keep gravitating towards how we can draw that in and how we can provide those services. Next slide, please. Future goals. Touched on this a little bit, I think twice now, but in devotion to our mission, it's paramount that ICU finds a way to build on our partnerships and resources in order to expand the mental health project to be able to provide therapy accessibility in various languages. It's crucial that immigrants have the opportunity to receive this service in their native tongue. So we've talked about a lot of different things. I think one thing that is worth mentioning is that prior to me starting here at ISCU in May of last year, I worked at Courage Connection, where I was working with immigrants that were not only being abused by their intimate partner or by a family member, but also by the system because they were immigrants, right? So the trauma was a lot to unravel, and I had no resources because I couldn't put them through Courage Connection's resources and say, okay, got this, now you can go to one of our therapists, right? Because we didn't have a therapist that spoke Spanish. And so this is a crisis that I've seen now for several years, and one of the things that really drew me to ISU was the initiative that they were taking with saying, this is something that we need to address. Maybe we don't have everything else figured out. Maybe we don't have all the funds for everything else figured out, but mental health is absolutely something that is non-negotiable. So we've talked about going out in the community and having workshops with local therapists in the area who speak other languages and just presenting to them the importance of immigrant mental health and saying, hey, this is the struggle that we have. Unless we have some kind of partnership or some deal with someone, like, it's very difficult. So that's something that we've considered doing. It's definitely important that we expand, just in the sense that CHP is not always going to be able to meet our quota for sessions that we have. So, okay. Next slide. Oh, there we go. I think if you click it again, there's a picture. There we go. So as a case manager, I'll do my best to answer your questions. If I can't, then I'll have to refer to my support system here. Okay.
Yeah, could you tell me a little bit more about the the duration of your mental health services do you, once somebody understands
sure.
that they need that help,
sure.
then what do you
So provide? Typically we're going for, our goal there is to have 6 initial sessions and then mm-hmm. to do a little bit of a reevaluation, like, you know, how did this go for you? Would you like to continue and things like that? But that's something they typically communicate directly with CHP. But we're definitely seeing people very often want to extend beyond 6 sessions and want to do 12, if not more, sessions.
Mm-hmm. And then how about the language acquisition piece? Is that mm-hmm. part, do you offer a way in your agency for people to study English or a referral, or how does
yeah,
that work?
Go ahead. I'm going to let Trey answer that one.
Okay.
Yeah, so currently we do not have those particular services. However, some of the potential programs that we are developing do directly focus on that. As you saw perhaps when we walked in and me and Chris were like, ha, we know each other. My background is from the higher ed administrative space. So both having language as well as cultural learning, being able to even look at the ethnography and look at how they can participate in different resources and learn languages through that experiential based learning will absolutely be a part of what I'll be bringing to ISCU. And hopefully while I'm hired, I don't know, we got to ask David about that one.
So who are some of your like other funders? Do you get like federal funding? Do you get state funding?
David, correct me if I'm wrong. As far as my awareness, I'm not sure there's many federal funding opportunities when it comes to serving immigrants. So all of our funds are state funds. Do you want to? It sounds cooler on this.
Sure. There is a national and international structures for refugees, and there's lots of funding for that legal category of immigrants, which are supported by the national government. But for people who are asylum seekers, who are undocumented, there is no national program that's providing resources. There are just efforts to curtail the people. So we have a inadequate but substantial donations from individuals and local businesses and church groups that are just essential for our operations. And when Maria says that the transportation and the warehouse and some of those other services we provide are not funded, they're funded through private donations. They aren't grant funded. And one of the, we're always seeking grant funding for those areas where there are just no other state and federal programs for these people. So they're really falling through the cracks. We have a United Way grant, which has been very helpful as well. And ARPA from starting with the COVID. There's been a real push to help the most vulnerable people. So those are our two main other grant funding resources.
Thank you, David.
Okay, first, the warehouse. Do you have a website or a page where I can get the address to that?
Yes.
I'd like to throw some stuff your way. So do you have a web page, or do you just want to give me an address?
We do have a web page.
Okay.
We're located in the basement of the Champaign County Public Health Building.
Oh, okay.
Alongside the Refugee Center, an immigrant cooperative, essentially. And then our warehouse is located in that building.
Okay.
So it's not typically set up in the sense that we have individuals come through the warehouse and kind of do like, oh, I need this, I need that, I need this. The warehouse is storage for us. But we do have like essentially like an intake that we complete with clients to be like, what is it that you need? And then we'll deliver the items directly to their home.
Okay, perfect.
But if you want to come check it out, you are more than welcome to come
check
it out.
Yeah, I would. At the minimum, I'm going to throw y'all some people I have that are upper middle class making nice donations.
Awesome.
Like, where should we take this, Chris?
Yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah. We're incredibly fortunate with the donations that we receive. We have people all the time that call and say, hey, I'm moving out. I have this or I have that. And, you know, the biggest thing that we need is mattresses. But
can't help you there, any one of those.
Yeah.
but I understand why,
but,
definitely.
You know, anything that's donated is you know, we don't take just anything, but the things that we need, and we know that we
I hate it when people
provide.
Try to donate
what
basically is their trash.
Yeah, we don't
it's
do like,
oh,
just drop stuff off, and we'll see what we can do with it. You know, like, we still want to make sure that we're providing items that have some longevity to them. We don't just want to be handing out, you know, scraps and things like that. But, yeah, we're really lucky to be able to have the warehouse so close to our own offices.
And another thing I want to point out, there's probably not a way to do this, but I wish you'd get some funding from the University of Illinois. Before I went back to academia... Well, listen to where I'm going. Maybe the same place you were thinking, Trey. Before I went back to academia, I worked the restaurant circuit 20 years. Yeah. And Mexicans, Latin Americans, and South Americans propped that whole campus up with providing service. And, of course, you also have international students that are propping the university up. And it seems like they need to find a way to give back. I know that's generally private industry, so you can't.
Sure.
Just something you should think about. I have no idea if there's a route to do that.
Right.
But if you need any help from me, let me know.
We will absolutely take the help side for sure. I will say that we are making a push to get UIUC and Parkland more involved. But the way that that happens, as far as I was concerned, is, like I said, I've already brought up this experiential-based learning component. It's that we need to offer something to the students. There's a lot of, like, social work courses or higher ed courses that will try to get students to be involved within organizations. A part of what I know, I've already, like, when I swear I did it from the first day that I was here, it had already been put into motion. It was kind of creating an experiential-based institute that shows how do you work with migrant communities in the first place, because though we've brought this language barrier up so much, there's the cultural one, there's what Maria brought up about what help that they're willing to accept, and if we just come in at it with a saviorist mentality, which UIUC often does, we're going to fall quite short. There is definitely programs in place, and then also ethical data collection for researchers that would be there, because if you could research migrants, we need to tell you how to do it ethically and allow them to be able to, with their organic intellectualism, guide where they will be going.
I knew I liked you.
I might.
I want to make a comment, but I'm not sure even what to say because my colleagues did such a fantastic job. I really, really appreciated your presentation. I think one thing that really stuck out to me was the focus on coming through case management.
Yes.
As opposed to not necessarily, like, the other kinds of marketing attempts, you know, might be helpful in some instances, but this idea of, like, I can more easily connect to the idea of getting mental health support through a direct connection with a person, I think is so important. And I guess maybe I was wondering, what are some of the places that you're finding as case manager that, like, I guess referral sources to come through you that then help to come through to the mental health side, like our schools and like things like that?
Yeah, that's a great question. I would say one thing that we're seeing the most, one thing that I'm working with right now is a relationship with Carl, because they're seeing a lot of immigrants that are coming in, and as they are sitting with them, they're realizing there's a great mental health need here with this client. So they actually want to have me come down there and give a presentation to their psychiatric department to just talk about immigrant mental health. So we're seeing a lot of the reason I bring that up is to say we're seeing a lot of referrals coming through, like, medical institutions and things like that. The school, absolutely. See You Early, that was here earlier, has a caseworker who is just marvelous and goes above and beyond, doing so much more than I think what she's supposed to be doing. So she refers a lot of clients to us. we have a couple of churches that we work with, and when they have individuals, there's one church in particular that will refer several clients to us throughout the month, new arrivals as they come in, because obviously they feel safe enough in their church to be able to talk about mental health. So yeah, there's always more outreach that needs to be done. Absolutely is important, but thankfully we are seeing that the partners that we do have or the relationships that we do establish are definitely making referrals.
Yeah, and as next steps in the referral process, there's a new community. We want to go to the Congolese community a lot more. I know we said that we are lacking some of the staff necessary. Like, we don't have a bunch of French speakers. I do it a little bit. It's terrible. It will not happen here. But some of the next steps are going to also some of their institutions, whether that's Best of Africa Market, whether that's going to, I believe it's Meadowbrook and all that, that has the French direct services. But yeah, we also are trying to make sure that our idea of diaspora and immigration is not just specific to Latino, Latinx communities, and recognize the diversity of diasporas that come here. So some of the next outreaches will also land us hopefully with that community soon as well, to get some referrals coming out of those institutions.
Yeah. And to kind of elaborate and touch more on your comment, I think that's why it's so important to look at case management and the mental health program as interdependent, because I'm actually the main like outreach person in that sense, right? Maybe someone doesn't come to me because they're seeking mental health services. Maybe they just are seeking the warehouse or whatever it might be, but through my advocacy work, I'm able to direct them towards that, even if that's not why they came to my office. I'm sure you guys are ready to head out. So,
I just wanted to add thank you so much for your work, and I think just like as you described the success story, mm-hmm. I mean, it was so striking the number of different things that this family had experienced.
Yes.
That I think is really, really important to highlight why it's so important to focus on these services. So I really, really thank you all for being here and for your presentation. Any other comments?
I'll just touch on that really quick before I wrap up and say that case is not an anomaly. No. That is very much what the cases that we are seeing look like. That case maybe is a little bit different in the sense that you're seeing assassination in it of a direct family member. But in terms of family members having experienced such a degree of violence that they fled their country, we're seeing that in almost every case. Yeah.
And I would double down on specifically the getting diseases or exposed to that in the shelter spaces during immigration. I also would want to put a little bit of an eye on that as well. Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so, so much for your presentation. With that, we just have a few items on the agenda. The first is agency input. We have heard from some fantastic agencies this evening, but if there are any other comments that anyone would like to share from any agencies, we will limit you to 5 minutes, and that includes anybody that might be online as well. Probably no one on the chat. All right, seeing as there is none, the next item is board announcements and input. Any announcements or input from our board members?
I have one small exciting piece of news because I get updates on my phone and I'm addicted to my phone. The state delays cuts for individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities. They've pushed it off till at least July 1st. So again, that was $90 million. And I think tonight each one of our presenters talked about how they need X number more millions than what they're getting. And I think that's why I stay on an appointed board, because I don't know if I could consciously sit on our county board or our state government and do some of the crazy things that are being done by our legislators. So that's all I'll say on the record. So whenever you get those things from Lynn of, hey, fill out a witness statement, I'm always like, yep, you know, and so I share things on Facebook too. So maybe a few of us, you know, sharing what the heck are they thinking down there? Maybe it caught some attention. And Chapin Rose, I think, thankfully from our local area, led the fight on this. So I'm very thankful of that.
So that just happened like during this meeting. Well, thank you for sharing that. That's great to hear. Yes. Any other board announcements or input? Seeing none, with that, we can adjourn the study session. Thank you all for coming, and I hope you have a good night.
Recording stopped.